Well, thank you all for coming tonight. Martine and I have been on the road a couple of weeks in America, and it's always very humbling, really, to know that our work is known about as far afield as New Mexico. The topic that I gave as the title for this evening's reflection was, or is, the lay Buddhist. And I want this evening just to think about what that might mean today. Now, maybe I should start by saying something of my own story, because after all, I began my formal training in Buddhism as a monk, but for most of my time now as both a practitioner, a teacher, a writer within the Buddhist world, I have been a lay person. And those of you who are familiar with my writings are probably aware that I'm not interested in simply perpetuating any particular school of Buddhism, nor am I interested in trying to preserve a specific Asian tradition. My quest, I think, from a very early time in my practice has been to try and understand what do these teachings, these practices, which we call the Dhamma or the Dharma, how do they speak to our condition here and now in the early 21st century, in a country, in a culture where Buddhism is really something very novel, unfamiliar, and in a sense a very small phenomenon. I started my own involvement when I was 19 years old. I'd left high school without any great academic distinction. And I traveled overland across to India from England along what was called the Hippie Trail. And this took me through countries through the Middle East, through Iraq, into Iran, into Afghanistan, into Pakistan, names which now have a very different resonance to what they did then. In other words, basically a war zone. In those days, you could, as a young backpacker, just take buses and hitch rides and jump on trains and do whatever you needed to do to get from A to B. And these places were, you know, peaceful, very fascinating for a young person brought up in a rather protected world of middle-class England, to be exposed to this very, very different world, which of course was and still is how the majority of people on this planet live. Having crossed the border from Pakistan into India, I made my way up to Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama and his community of Tibetan refugees had settled. But remember, this was only 12 or so years after they had left Tibet. The Dalai Lama was then 37 years old, 15 years younger than I am now. He had never been out, he'd never been to the West. In fact, the very year I arrived in Dharamsala was the year that Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon went to China, opened the China door, which was also the closing of the Tibet door. All the help the Americans had been providing, which wasn't much, was suddenly cut off. Mm-hmm. The Dalai Lama was refused a visa for the United States until the Carter administration. So it was not until 20 years after he left Lhasa, fleeing a communist regime, that he was allowed into the land of the free. But of course, since then, as we know, He has perhaps more than any other single person brought Buddhist values and wisdom and practices to the attention of an enormous number of people. So he's been an extraordinary ambassador. But it was very different in 1972. I was extraordinarily struck by the Tibetan people, who had lost everything, in some senses almost overnight, and had fled over the Himalayas and found themselves in India, a country about which they knew nothing, and found themselves to be refugees in one of the poorest places in the world. And yet, coming from a privileged English background, I found for the first time men and women, not only the lamas and the monks, but just the simple people who lived in the community, I was extraordinarily moved by how, in spite of their devastating material hardship and their loss of their country, they nonetheless retained an extraordinary joie de vivre, a joyousness, a brightness, a hopefulness, a stillness, a certain radiance, a warmth and openness, and a willingness to offer everything that they had in their culture to myself and others like myself, rather alienated, confused young men and women. And they gave us the Dhamma without any sense that this was something that they could charge for or make some money out of. It was all given for free. And I think that was probably one of the most important experiences in my life, to witness Buddhism not just as a set of ideas and beliefs and practices, but something that imbued the lives of these people with a certain set of values, of qualities that I found deeply admirable and deeply touching. So my conversion to Buddhism was a very almost immediate thing. I found myself from one day to the next transformed from a long-haired hippie type into a rather devout seminarian with a shoulder bag full of books, going to study at the feet of one or two lamas in Dharamsala. And within a year or so, I asked to be ordained as a monk, as a samanera, as a novice. And at the age of 21, I did in fact do that. And I have pursued my study and practice of Buddhism pretty much without break since then. In fact, it's all I've ever done. I have no other qualifications, academic or professional, and so please take whatever I have to say with an enormous pinch of salt. Buddhism has been very much my life, and that's not to say, however, that I have not had considerable struggles with it. My relationship, perhaps, as with a relationship in a marriage, is not a smooth, uninterrupted idyll of well-being, but frequently involves conflict, misunderstanding, contradictions, conflicting desires. And as I immerse myself in my monastic training with Tibetan lamas from the Tibetan Gelug school, I was trained in dialectics, which meant that I studied Buddhist logic, epistemology, philosophy. Not, as one sometimes thinks when one hears of Tibetan Buddhism, the exotica of mandalas and mantras and weird-looking deities, which I also did those practices as well. But my main interest was in Buddhist doctrine and philosophy. And I was trained really as to analyze and to critique these texts with the tools of rational inquiry. And this was really my education in Buddhism, for which I'm immensely grateful. The problem, however, was that I found that the tools of reasoning and dialectics with which we were given began to actually upset certain of the fundamental Buddhist beliefs that we were expected to hold as Buddhists, particularly those about rebirth, reincarnation, future lives, other realms of existence, the law of karma as occurs over lifetimes. And I found that the more I examined these things and discussed them with my fellow monks, the less I was really able to accept them as literally true. And this led to a dilemma, because after all I was being trained to be a priest effectively, more perhaps in the Gelug school a theologian, maybe a doctor of divinity, something like that. And yet I could not, in my heart of hearts, accept many of the tenets which were regarded as necessary to consider oneself a Buddhist. Now, this was not a purely academic problem. I would wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat, agonizing over a question such as, does a state of mind, a mental state, necessarily have to be the product of a prior mental state? In other words, according to the Buddhist tradition, mind is necessarily a product of mind and cannot be produced essentially from a physical organism or a brain, but needs to come from something intrinsically spiritual. That to me did not make much sense. And I found it very difficult to embrace ideas which basically were truth claims of a quasi-empirical nature about how the world worked, and yet did not seem to be supported either by reason, nor, and seemed to contradict or not fit very comfortably with how we understood the world in terms of modern science. So this was my first crisis of faith. I resolved it initially by adopting an agnostic position, for which I subsequently became somewhat well known through my book Buddhism Without Beliefs, which advances a kind of Buddhist agnosticism. In other words, agnosticism, which is the position that one does not know, agnosis, one does not know whether one survives physical death or not, whether there are past lives or not, whether there are other realms of existence or not. I found this a very liberating perspective to have. It was also convenient, if I think of it slightly more cynically, because it meant I didn't actually have to reject those ideas. And the problem was really one of remaining within the embrace of the tradition without rejecting its core tenets, and yet agnosticism allowed me not to reject them, but not to affirm them either. And I think there is, in a way, a strand within Buddhist tradition that would support such a stance. In any case, it served me very well. And it also showed me, and I think this is perhaps more to the point, that even if I knew, even if I was certain, that after death there would be absolutely nothing, it would just be brain death and that's it, that would not actually affect in any real way my commitment to the Buddhist practice. In other words, I realized, unlike what I was being taught by my teachers, that I was committed to this practice, the practice of awareness, the practice of ethics, the practice of concentration, the practice of wisdom, not because they would afford some future benefit after death, either a better life, or the avoidance of some ghastly hellish state, or the possibility of not even being reborn ever again, experiencing, attaining nirvana. Those ideas, those metaphysical beliefs, did really not impact upon my heartfelt commitment to the Dhamma, which was something that I valued because it had a transformative effect on my life here and now. That's what mattered to me. The rest was really rather academic and abstract. And yet I was being taught that I could not, in fact, seriously consider myself a Buddhist unless I had no concerns for this life and my entire existential commitment was to the succession of future lifetimes throughout samsara. There's a famous Tibetan verse which says, "Tse di la shena chöba min." If you're concerned with this life, you are not a chöba, you're not a Dharma person. And I found that strange. And I continue to find that strange. In any case, I don't want to go too autobiographic on this talk. I also had trouble with Tibetan forms of Vajrayana practice, which entailed much visualization of deities and mandalas and reciting mantras and being initiated into this, that, and the other. It was not a practice that I really was at all comfortable with or felt any competence in doing. On the other hand, by a rather strange set of circumstances, shortly after I was ordained as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, Mr. Goenka came to town. He came to Dharamsala and he gave a 10-day retreat in the Institute, the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, where I was studying. I don't know why, but I did this 10-day retreat and it completely transformed my whole sense of what Buddhist meditation was about. I'd never done anything like it before. I'd never had that kind of intense, concentrated, silent meditation in which I just focused on my breath, on my bodily sensations, on my vedana, my feelings. And that was enormously powerful. It probably would not have been so effective had I not had quite a long training already in Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist ideas that I'd learned from my Tibetan teachers. So I think it was the two together. But the Goenka practice really gave me a foundation, which is still the foundation I have right now, of meditation as based upon satipatthana, the grounding or the establishment of mindful attention. After a few years, about 7 or 8 years as a monk in the Tibetan tradition, I decided, for a number of reasons which I'm not going to go into here, that I needed a practice environment where I could focus entirely on meditation and that kind of training. And I decided to enter a monastery in South Korea called Songwangsa, under the guidance of a Zen master called Kuzan Sunim. And I spent 4 years there doing two 3-month retreats a year, summer and winter, in a zendo in the forests of South Korea, simply asking a kungan or a koan, "What is this?" And that's all we did. There was no idea in this tradition that you passed koans and went on to other ones. You just stayed with this primal, existential perplexity and just went into that, became, as they say in the texts, a mass of doubt. And since doubt was what I was kind of into at that time anyway, this was a very appropriate form of practice. And it led me very much to an experience in which really, really sort of infused my whole sense of who I was with this quality of questioning, of uncertainty, of perplexity, of puzzlement, what we might in a more slightly more mystical language speak of a sense of the mysterious, a sense of mystery, a sense of the sheer strangeness of being here. The sheer oddness of the fact that we're here rather than not here, that we exist rather than don't exist. As they say in some Western philosophical texts, an astonishment at the fact there is something at all rather than nothing. That was very fundamental to my practice and still remains so. That sense of the sheer limitation of the human mind to grasp in all of its in all of its enormity and mystery, the sheer fact of being here. And I found that the Zen practice, combined with certain elements of the Buddhist philosophy that I had trained in within my Tibetan teachers, provided me with a kind of perspective on Buddhism that was becoming increasingly kind of my own. I could not at that point really identify with any honesty with being a Zen Buddhist or with being a Tibetan Buddhist, with being a Mahayana Buddhist, with being a Theravada Buddhist. These labels came to mean less and less to me. And so it was after my period in Korea, our teacher, Kuzan Sunim, had died, I realized that I didn't wish to pursue that training any further. Martine and I recognized that we wanted to get married, and so I disrobed and returned with Martine to the community in southwest England near Gaia House that was mentioned, and that was in 1985, and I lived there as a layperson for 15 years. I've now lived in France for nearly 10 years, likewise as a layperson. And in those years, in these last 25 years or so, my interest has been increasingly and almost exclusively into the study of the texts of the Pali Canon, and more recently into an attempt to reconstruct as clearly as possible the historical Buddha, the man Siddhartha Gautama, who lived 2,500 years ago in North India. And in a way, what I've been trying to do is to try to get back as close as I can to what it was that was distinctive in what this man said at his time, in what kind of world he lived, under what sort of pressures was his life subject to, what sort of relationships did we have with his students, his monks, the various lay figures of his time, the kings, the merchants, and so on, to try to get back inside his present time. And this has led me to spend a lot of time in India recently, going back to the sites where he lived and he taught throughout North India on pilgrimage. I've become a bit of a pilgrim in that regard. And throughout all of this, I've been writing. And some of you might be familiar with my books. My books are really my preferred way of learning. I find if I want to understand something, write about it. This struck me when I started back in the early 70s, when I was studying the Tibetan language. I found the best way to study a Tibetan text was to translate it myself, so that I really had to get a clear grasp of what each of these words meant, how the syntax of the sentence worked, and to achieve a kind of intimacy almost, both with the written text and as one proceeded through the text with the person behind those words, the author of those words. And so in that sense, I found that although I don't have great linguistic skills, I feel, nonetheless, through my studies of language, I've also entered into a kind of a closeness with the textual tradition, the philosophical tradition, and above all, the minds of those men, because it is always men, who wrote these texts. I've never studied Buddhism as an academic. In fact, I feel a certain aversion to the style of learning that is current in departments of religious studies in universities in the West, where one has to assume a certain critical distance. And that also means a kind of existential distance, that what is of interest is to pick these parts, pick primarily texts apart in order to gain some quasi-scientific objective knowledge of their meaning, of their history, and so on, but never to allow your own subjective biases and preferences to come into play. In fact, I think that's impossible, in fact. But as a stance, as a perspective on the tradition, I was not willing to do that, because these texts are not a matter of cold indifference to me. These texts speak to my own condition. I have a relationship with them that is interactive, and it is subjective. I find their value not in the ideas or the doctrines, the metaphysics that they may state, but their value lies in how they speak to my condition here and now. And so that subjective interactive relationship with the textual tradition is to me of central and critical importance. So in that sense, I found myself rather in a sort of no man's land. I'm not at home in any particular Buddhist school. I'm not a Theravada Buddhist, a Zen Buddhist, a Tibetan Buddhist. I can't accept the bodies of orthodoxy, in other words, those time-honored systems of interpretation that are preserved and upheld in particular schools, be those the interpretations of Buddhaghosa or of Tsongkhapa or of Chinul or of Dogen. As much as they can illuminate and often provide great insights, I cannot accept them as the last word or the definitive interpretation of what Buddhist tradition is about. I think all of those interpretations are appropriate or were appropriate to the conditions under which they arose in Sri Lanka or in Burma or in Tibet or in Japan, but they do not, I feel, they're not adequate, I feel, for addressing the complexities and the peculiarities of the conditions of modernity under which we live in a largely secular Christian or post-Christian society in Western Europe or in the United States. And at the same time, I cannot feel myself identified as being a Buddhist scholar with a certain academic authority or the position of anyone within a university or anything like that. So I find myself kind of on my own, I therefore have to live somewhat by my wits. I don't have any institutional body that will pay my rent. And I find this both somewhat unsettling at times, insecure, but also it's liberating. And I find that each of my books, in a way, is simply an account of where I happen to be on this journey when that book was published. I don't have a particular view that I wish to somehow keep propagating, but rather it seems that people find it of help that I share the outlines of my own journey, really. But what I think so much of this has brought me back to is the sense that in some ways Buddhist tradition has lost sight of what was radical in what Siddhartha Gautama, the historical Buddha, did. And it's here that I wish to begin to address my notion of a laity. Buddhist tradition, as we know only too well, has been one that has been preserved through its history in pretty much every culture where it has flourished by communities of monks and nuns. And I do not wish in any sense to denigrate that achievement. I think it's extraordinary. I think it's extraordinary that the Buddhist monastic tradition has remained intact, largely, for such a period of time. I think it must be one of the oldest religious institutions in the world that's ever survived. And it has enabled me and you and everyone here to be able to reflect and to study and to practice within this tradition. One can never forget that. But at the same time, I feel that what the Buddha was doing was not something that was exclusively directed at those who had chosen to become monks or nuns. One of the parables that he gives, which I've thought about quite a lot recently, is the parable of the city. He says, suppose, bhikkhus or monks, a man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path. He would follow it and he would find an ancient city, an ancient capital with parks, groves, ponds and ramparts, a delightful place. And then that man would inform the king or a royal minister, sire, know that while wandering through the forest I saw an ancient path, I followed it and came to an ancient city. Renovate that city, sire. And then the king or his minister would renovate that city, and sometime later that city would become successful and prosperous, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. So too, monks, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road, travelled by the Buddhas of the past. And what is that ancient path? It is just this noble eightfold path, appropriate seeing, thinking, speaking, acting, working, making effort, practicing mindfulness, concentration. And I followed that path, and by doing so, I have come to know directly the Four Noble Truths. Now, I'd often heard this passage referred to, but normally it just referred to the path, the Eightfold Path, the path in the forest. It was only when I recently checked the text in the canon that I found that the path actually led to an ancient city. And when the Buddha explains the meaning of the symbolism, the path refers to the Eightfold Path. The city refers to the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering, its origins, the cessation of suffering, and then the Eightfold Path again. Now, this struck me as odd. One would have expected, perhaps, for the Buddha to say that I followed the Eightfold Path and it led me to Nirvana. After all, that's often classically how the Eightfold Path is depicted, the noble Eightfold Path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And yet here we have a different take altogether. For a start, we have the idea of a city. We have the idea that the city, the Buddha saw what he was doing, this Eightfold Path that he was presenting, this way of life, having as its object, having as its destination, not the cessation of suffering, the ceasing of the round of rebirth, the experience of Nibbana, but rather the Eightfold Path leads to the possibility of another way of living in this world as a community. And even more than that, as a civilization, as a civitas, as a city. Of course, we find this image also in Christianity. The city on the hill, Jerusalem, the city of God in Augustine. And here too we have the Buddha likewise seeing his path as one that would restore or renew on earth a new kind of civilization. And a civilization that will be founded upon the template of the Four Ennobling Truths. Now, we don't have time this evening to go into exactly, well, how would the Four Truths be a template for a civilization? That seems quite explicit here. Quite explicit. And I think in order to understand that, we have to really go back to the very earliest sermon, the first discourse the Buddha gave in the Deer Park at Sana, in order to try to see how he meant that, not as a template for spiritual liberation, but as a template for civilization, for culture. I think this is already somehow suggested in the very structure of the Eightfold Path itself. The Eightfold Path, as you no doubt are aware, refers not just to a path of spiritual practice. It refers to how we see ourselves and the world, how we think about them, how we communicate with others, how we act in the world, how we earn our livelihood, how we make efforts, how we focus and consolidate our lives, and then how we pay attention mindfully, how we develop concentration. And we have to also think, or we don't have to, but I'm suggesting we might also see that this picture the Buddha gives in this image is one in which we're not talking about achieving some sort of final end point, but rather we have a kind of holomorphic process at work. We have an eightfold path that leads to four noble truths, the fourth of which is the eightfold path, which leads to four noble truths, the fourth of which is the eight, and you get my picture. I think that this is not accidental. We can see the same pattern structurally in the first sermon itself, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the discourse on the turning of the wheel of Dhamma, which likewise the Buddha starts by saying, I have awoken to a middle path, which is the Eightfold Path, and then he jumps straight into the Four Noble Truths. And then he describes his awakening, his enlightenment, as having had a complete understanding of these four truths in all their aspects. That his awakening was the awakening to the four truths. It wasn't the awakening to the unconditioned or to Nibbana, but to the four truths. We keep coming back to the four truths. Now, as one begins to rethink, in a way, some of these basic Buddhist ideas, it seems to me at least, that there's a somewhat different a set of possibilities being opened up in these ideas than is often the case of what is presented to us in a lot of Buddhist tradition, which seems to prioritize a certain kind of spiritual attainment which leads to the experience of Nibbana and the cessation of rebirth, and something which is therefore primarily an experience that is private, something that we experience deep within the core of ourselves, but only secondarily is this something that then becomes part of a framework of a social or an ethical condition. Of course, to do this practice, there's necessary to have an ethical, moral foundation for it. But again, the ethics is seen to, in some respects, subordinate to the emphasis on spiritual attainment. And most Buddhist traditions today tend to put the emphasis on enlightenment, on awakening, on some kind of quasi mystical, liberative state of mind. And that becomes the goal. The value of the community, of the society, is to support that process in whatever ways it can. But this, I think, has perhaps somewhat biased the whole tradition towards the monk or the nun as the exemplary embodiment of what the Buddhist tradition is about. And I wonder if perhaps we have to even put that into question. We do nonetheless find, when we read through the suttas, we find passages where the Buddha is very affirmative about the practice of people who are not monks and nuns. And this is a passage from Majjhima 73, the 73rd middle-length discourse. And the Buddha says, there are not only 100 or 500, but far more men and women lay followers, my disciples, clothed in white, enjoying sensual pleasures, I like that bit. Who carry out my instruction, respond to my advice, have gone beyond doubt, become free from perplexity, gained intrepidity, and become independent of others in my teaching. Now, this is a classic definition of what is called stream entry. Again, this term, I've always been struck by this term, they become independent of others in my teaching. A stream entry is often described as the loss of three primary fetters: the individuality view, attachment to morals and rituals, and doubt about the validity of the path. But again, if you think about it, that's a terribly, again, a very, very subjective definition. It's talking about certain inner elements of one's consciousness somehow being transformed. And the Buddha, of course, does speak of it in that way. But strangely, not very often. I've actually only found one passage in the whole Pali canon of the suttas where the Buddha actually defines stream entry in that way. It's in the Sutta Nipata, which is a very early source, so it's a very sound one. But in a whole section of texts, which we find in the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses of the Buddha, there is a section called the Sotapatti Samyutta, the connected discourses on the stream entry. And here the Buddha doesn't define stream entry in this way at all. He speaks of it in terms of achieving confirmed confidence in the Buddha, confirmed confidence in the Dhamma, and confirmed confidence in the Sangha, and has embraced the virtues which are dear to the noble ones. That's stream entry. The stream, in fact, that's what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. There's another passage also in the same section of text where he says he's talking to his disciple Sariputta. Sariputta, he says, The stream. Now what, Sariputta, is the stream? And Sariputta replies, this noble eightfold path is the stream. That is, and then he lists the eight. A stream enterer, what is that, Sariputta? One who possesses this noble eightfold path is a stream enterer. Now if we take those texts, which are the longest continuous sequence of texts in the canon regarding the topic of stream entry, if we take those as primary, we have a very different sense. Here we have the stream entrant is the person who has turned his or her life around to in such a way that they now live by a different set of core commitments and values than they did beforehand. It's a relationship to one's life in all its complexity, what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, what we see, think, speak, act, do, our commitment to the idea of what the Buddha embodies, the practice of the Dhamma, which again is a very complex idea, and of course our connection to the Sangha. And when he defines the Sangha here, he doesn't talk of it in terms of the monks and the nuns, which is often the case nowadays, but rather the Sangha are those who have entered the stream and achieved the different levels of awakening, culminating in that of arhantship. So this is a model that is just as open to a layperson. And if one thinks of it, especially in terms of this path being one that is about the creation of a city, it requires not just full-time religious professionals to achieve this, nor does it require just people who have attained certain spiritual accomplishments, but it requires a whole community, a whole society, to live and act together in such a way that a whole different kind of culture begins to emerge. And I wonder in some ways that here we are sitting together, all of us are lay people. I don't know how many of you are inspired to become monastics, but I suspect that's probably not the majority. And yet we feel somehow a commitment, a valuing of what the Buddha's saying. And nonetheless, I feel that although our lives are so different from those of the many of the lay people at the Buddha's time, many of whom would have been, you know, tied to an agrarian subsistence lifestyle. There would have been merchants, perhaps, and some aristocrats and nobility who wouldn't have had those responsibilities. But the bulk of people would have been very much involved in subsistence agriculture. That's not our situation anymore at all. We have to remember that at the time of the Buddha, to become a monk or a nun, and again, I think we should use those words in English with some caution, monk, nun imply, again, full-time religious professionals, cut off from the world very often. The bhikkhu and the bhikkhuni never really meant that. To become a bhikkhu, to become a bhikkhuni, literally meant to become a beggar. What my friend Ajahn Sucitto calls a virtuous bum. To understand these ideas, we really have to try to locate them in terms of what they meant in 500 BC. And that's not easy. I don't have time to go into all of that now. But basically, to become a bhikkhu or a bhikkhuni meant simply to leave behind the restrictions of the home life, which for most people would have meant a life of basically toil from dawn to dusk. It would have meant a life in which you had no opportunity for education. It meant, as a woman, that you would be subject to yearly pregnancies, probably, and a high chance of dying in one of them. To become a monk or nun basically meant to commit yourself to a life of the mind, to reflection, to study, to discussion, to ideas, to contemplation, to meditation, to all of these different things. And in fact, in much of Buddhism's history in Asia, that continued to be the case. So it's not quite equivalent to the Christian notion of monk or nun, especially in an enclosed cenobitic communities. These were wandering mendicants. And again, a very beautiful expression we find in the Pali Canon. The Buddha says, after the monk or the bhikkhu or the bhikkhuni has had their initial training, to go forth into the world for the welfare of the many, out of compassion for the many, and let no two of you follow the same path. In other words, he wanted a body of men and women who had achieved what he calls independent, had become independent of others in my teaching, had achieved an autonomy in their practice, and once that had been done, to go forth into the world, the Buddha's order, maximize social mobility within the community. It wasn't an ascetic order that sought to privilege certain practices that, like the Jains, for example, where you concentrated in remote areas exclusively in spiritual practice. He wanted his followers to be in the world, of the world. Now, I think nowadays, paradoxically perhaps, many Buddhist, ordained Buddhist monks and nuns have a degree of security in having temples and having lay supporters and so on, in which they actually in a situation which is rather like home again, rather than homelessness. And in some ways, a lay Buddhist teacher who doesn't have those sorts of supports is in a way in a more homeless situation, where one has to live rather by one's wits. Where one can't depend upon others to provide for one, necessarily. So I think we're in a situation now where a lot of the assumptions that Buddhist tradition has carried with it for the 2,500 years of its history are thrown into question. I think it's premature and naive to say, to predict what kind of Dharma will emerge in the modern world, in the West, in America, in Europe and elsewhere. But I find it difficult to imagine it will bear a great deal of similarity to what has gone so far in the past. Most of us here are in a situation where we have a sufficient leisure, we have education, we have resources that can enable us to pursue these ideas and practices in our own time, sometimes even on our own terms, without having to opt for a kind of monastic lifestyle. Or we may, especially in places like Burma and Thailand today, we can do part-time ordinations, which I think is a wonderful thing to do. I'm not trying to suggest that monastic training is something we need to forget about. In fact, the more that that sort of possibility becomes available, I think the enormous potential of such a lifestyle can be shared so much more widely without lifelong commitments. So we're entering into a very new sort of situation, into very uncharted territories. And in some ways, I feel we have to, in a way, start all over again. Go back to beginnings. And I see that in two terms primarily. Going back to the primary questions within our own life that are posed to us simply through the fact of being born, of growing sick, growing old and having to die. What does that mean? How can, in this brief span of earth, can I optimize my capacities as a human being? And in what way can the Buddha's teaching somehow assist me in that process? But also going back to beginnings and starting all over again in terms of our understanding and of our relation to the tradition itself, going back to the primary texts. In this case, we can't go back further than the Pali Canon and the Chinese Agamas, which are an equivalent body of texts translated from the Sanskrit. And also trying to recover the Buddha as a human being in a social, political, economic environment that we can increasingly relate to, rather than as an almost godlike, perfect figure who has become almost out of reach in terms of our own experience. That's it. I'm not going to say any more. We have still some time, I think. Dharma talk, what does it say? Discussion Q&A. Any comments, any questions, anything anyone would like to say? Yes?
I have a question. You said that you were an agnostic.
I were, oh, okay.
So are you still agnostic?
Okay, the question, for those of you who may not have heard, I said somewhere in the course of that rant that I was an agnostic. The question, therefore, am I still an agnostic? Well, yes and no. I'm not sure. I found a lot of my readers, as I meet on events like this, are a little upset that I'm no longer waving the agnostic flag. Some people are actually quite angry. I don't know whether that applies to you. But the problem is, agnosticism can also become another thing we can become attached to. And in fact, you know, we can perhaps be agnostic about everything except agnosticism. Very easy. But I think I find all of these terms, agnostic, atheist, secularist, humanist, I can relate to all of them. And in different contexts and different occasions, at different with different topics, I will adopt a slightly different position. I'm not as agnostic as I used to be. In other words, if it comes, for example, to the doctrine of reincarnation and rebirth, however you translate it, rather than say, well, actually, I don't know. At some level, that's true. I don't know. Nobody knows. So we're all agnostic. Even believers, and this is one of the reasons why agnostic becomes a little bit problematic, because even all religious believers are agnostics. They have to be, because they don't know that there is God or that there is rebirth, but they believe that there is. So that is necessarily somewhat agnostic. Agnostic is just a rather fancy word to describe the fact that human knowledge is limited. We can only know so much with any certainty. And if you really are honest with yourself, if I'm really honest with myself, and I ask myself, what do I know for sure? It's very little. Very, very little. Most of my view of the world and so on is based on belief. I believe there was a Big Bang. I believe in the theory of evolution. I believe that this body is composed of millions of subatomic particles. But if I had to persuade someone who didn't believe those things that that was the case, as I've actually had to do with some of my Tibetan friends, I can't do it. I just become as, it's exposed as belief. So agnosticism, I think, has certain weaknesses. It also, I think, is often a cop-out. It just be able to say, well, I don't know. That's the truthful answer. I really don't know. But often we do need to take a stance. We do need to be able to say, well, actually, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that this is probably the case. And so regarding reincarnation, I don't think there is any reincarnation or rebirth, because I simply cannot, I find the idea incoherent. I cannot philosophically or in terms of what we know scientifically about the human person find any way to be able to meaningfully say that after death I could be reborn as a Staffordshire Bull Terrier on Park Avenue called Henry. Now, I know that sounds a bit silly, but the point is it's very easy to make these claims in the abstract. I will be reborn as an animal. Okay, now let's just narrow that down and let's imagine it's a Staffordshire Bull Terrier who lives on Park Avenue called Henry. In what sense can Stephen, who's talking to you now, become Henry on Park Avenue who has a predilection for dog food? I just don't know what that means. I really don't know what that means. So I can't honestly say with any honesty that, well, maybe there is rebirth. I don't think there is. But, of course, many Buddhists will throw up their hands in horror and say, well, in that case, we're all just going to degenerate into a sort of barbarity. There'll be no basis for ethics or morals, which is nonsense. The rebirth has nothing to do with morals. The law of action and the fact that action has consequences, that is the moral basis, not whether you go from one life to the next. I firmly believe, and I don't think it's a terribly remarkable thing to say, that the actions I commit now will have consequences beyond my death. I just don't believe that I will be around in some form or other to witness them. And I don't think that really matters. The important thing is that what we do now will have effects, and we need to be more and more conscious through our practice, through our meditation, on the consequences of what we think, what we say, what we do, how that impacts me subjectively and psychologically, how that impacts others with whom I live and whom I interact, and that the reverberations of those thoughts and actions will continue irrespective of whether I drop dead tomorrow or not. And so, in other words, karma is a doctrine of responsibility. It's a doctrine of recognizing that what we do now individually, collectively, as a society, as a people, as a race, will have an impact on the future life of those who inhabit this planet. And the only thing for which we can be certain is that life will continue on this planet after my death. There's no certainty at all that we will continue in some other form of life. And I would prefer to base my moral judgments and choices on the basis of something about which I can be relatively sure, rather than on the basis of a belief that, frankly, is an atavistic relic of ancient Indian civilization.
Mr. Dawkins would approve.
Mr. Dawkins would approve.
Yes. Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, they seem, at least to me, to be inseparable from the cultures where they exist. As you study the canon directly, do you see that? Do you try to filter it out? Do you just deal with it as it is? How do you work with it?
Okay, the question is...
You lived in a socioeconomic, political environment like everybody else.
The question has to do with all the forms of Buddhism we know, be it Theravada, Tibetan, Zen, or whatever, they necessarily are shot through, not your word, please correct Agami if I misrepresent you, but they reflect the culture of those particular places and times. And when one goes back to the early canon, how do you, as it were, tease apart the cultural accretions from the core ideas? Now, that's a very good question. In other words, we need to apply what is technically called a hermeneutic, a theory of interpretation. I'm reading a text in the Pali Canon, let's say, a sutta. Now, there'll be passages in there that I'll find are not culturally dependent. When the Buddha says, for example, you know, birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death of suffering, I don't have to be a Tibetan or a Burmese to believe that.
Universal, right.
So in that sense, it's universal. So in order to arrive at what it is that is distinctive to Buddhism, independent of any cultural assumptions, we need to start to differentiate those ideas which we can't, are not derivative to a particular cultural perspective. The example I gave is a very obvious one, but it's a rather important one, because after all, that's where the Buddha starts. So I think that shows us already that the Buddha is not concerned with somehow addressing issues that are specific to Indian culture, but rather he's addressing issues that are common to all human beings. But as the next steps he makes, or he's credited with making, is he then starts to speak of how, in order to resolve the question of birth, sickness, aging, and death, we need to find a way to eliminate their origins, which is ignorance and craving, in such a way that we won't get born again. In other words, the way out of birth, sickness, aging, and death is not to get born, get sick, to age, or die. As my Tibetan teacher used to say, no head, no headache. Which is, of course, true. But the problem is, as soon as he articulates this scheme of salvation, this teaching, he's now drawing upon ideas that are not common to all humanity, but are, of course, central to the Brahmanic Upanishadic tradition in which he was living. Because the idea of rebirth and karma, particularly the idea of rebirth, is something that's quite clearly in place before the Buddha in India. You find it in the Upanishads. It's even recent scholarship has shown that the idea is already there in the Rig Veda, which is about 1,000 years before the Buddha. So in other words, the Buddha was also unavoidably a creature of his time. He was both a revolutionary and a radical, but he was also an Indian of the 4th century BC, just in the same way that I am a modern of the late 20th, early 21st century, and I hold beliefs and views that I, as I already mentioned, I can't demonstrate or prove to be true, but that's part of my worldview. I take it on board, more or less for granted. It's part of our discourse, and that's the discourse within which I'll live and speak and argue and struggle. But I have to be aware that too, in, let's say, 2,000 years' time, will perhaps look as outdated as the one that you find in some of these early Buddhist texts. In other words, not make the mistake of certain cultural arrogance. Not to assume that what we currently regard as true, and with this, our current religion really is science, and what the scientists say is true. Well, it's very difficult for us to imagine how there may be other ways of seeing the world that will make that worldview look less compelling than it is for us now. It's very difficult. And I don't think it could have been any less difficult for the Buddha and his followers in their time to see their world differently. Added to the fact that in order simply to make sense in his own world, you know, that was the discourse of the time and the place. That's how people thought. It was as true for them as our scientific worldview is for us. But on the other hand, you do find passages. In the Kalama Sutta, at the end of the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha says quite clearly, he says, even if there is no rebirth, even if there is no law of karma, he says, nonetheless, to practice the Dhamma that I teach will bring you solace and well-being in this world here and now. The Buddha is even prepared to put those, what would have been primary cultural assumptions, at least in brackets, to suspend them. Maybe it's not like that. And again, we have these undeclared questions, where the Buddha says it doesn't matter whether the world is infinite or finite, beginningless or endless, whether the mind and the body are the same or different. That's an important one. Whether the mind and the body are the same or different. He doesn't make any statement about that. But if you don't make a statement about whether the mind and the body are the same or different, it's very difficult to construct a theory of reincarnation. Right? In fact, what Buddhist traditions have by and large adopted is a mind-body dualism. Body dies, mind or something or other. All the Buddhist schools disagree on what that something or other might be. The Bhavanga Chitta in the Theravada tradition, the subtle mind energy compound in Tibetan Buddhism or whatever, that does go on. But the Buddha is saying, don't go there. All the Buddhists did go there. And then is the Tathagata born after death, continues after death or not? I think what that means is simply, is there rebirth or not? The Buddha said, don't go there. And yet Buddhism did, in spades. So I think you have elements within the early tradition like those that are not derivative or cannot be deduced from the prevailing culture of the Buddha's time. This skepticism about rebirth, for example. This is something distinctive to the Buddha's teaching. So what I think I try to do when I read these texts is I have to ask myself, what is there in this text that is not deducible? I cannot infer it from the worldview of that period. In other words, what is really distinctive? And what is really distinctive in the Buddha's teaching is something that addresses the human condition, irrespective of time or place. And that, I feel, is what really has to be somehow clarified before we can begin, as it were, to reimagine how the Buddha's Dhamma may take form or shape or whatever in our world nowadays. And that's an enormous project. It's not something that I or a bunch of clever people are going to figure out. It's a generational work, probably.